Here's a quote for you. Parents are no longer eager to be parents. They want to love and guide their children as a trusted friend. Now, that remark is from author Jean Twenge, and she's studied and written about generational differences over several decades. And maybe you feel like you're on that tightrope between parenting and friendship with your child. Now, this is Focus on the Family with Jim Daly. I'm John Fuller, and today our host is Dr. Julie Slattery. And Julie, it probably sounds like a cliche to some, but it does seem that it's harder today to be a parent than ever before.
Well, John, I don't think you're going to get much argument from any parents on that one. In spite of all the resources we have at our fingertips, there's some really unique challenges in parenting today. And, you know, you mentioned Jean Twenge's book. It's called Generation Me. And I've really enjoyed studying what she has to say about young adults now and kind of seeing the way they were parented and how that's played out. You know, a lot of these kids have been raised with a mentality that life revolves around me.
Oh, yeah.
And then they hit life, and they hit getting that first paycheck and starting at the bottom of the corporate ladder and the difficulties that come in relationships. And we're finding that they're not as prepared for life as we'd hope they'd be.
Mm. Well, that's something that we can look around and see, isn't it? Now, our guest can certainly speak to this with some authority. It's John Rosemond, and he's an author and family psychologist. He's written a number of best-selling books about child rearing and family life. His wife is Willie, and they have two grown children and seven grandkids. His nationally syndicated column appears in some 200 newspapers. And John, it's good to have you back with us. I think it's been, a couple of months at least?
It has been, John. It's nice to be back.
Well, we're glad to have you. And I should mention that our Leadership Institute students are here in the studio as well. And Julie, you've had the pleasure of being an instructor for the Focus Leadership Institute for several years, and I know you love doing that.
I really do, and I've got to say, the students that come to the Leadership Institute are some of the best and the brightest, and it's always fun to have them here in the broadcast tapings and kind of get their take on some of the things we're talking about. Hmm. And John Rosemond, you and I actually met a couple years ago in my hometown, Akron, Ohio. You were there doing a parenting seminar, and we got a chance to chat for a little bit. And it's a great opportunity for me to get to reconnect with you today. And before I jump in, I want to go back to something that you said, John, at the top of the broadcast, that parenting is harder today than ever before. And that reminds me of something that I know, John, you really highlight, that being worn out is the modern badge of parenting courage. And I think there's a connection there. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, you know, I travel the country almost constantly, Julie and John, and I talk to audiences of parents hither and yon all over America. And there's a litany of complaint coming out of America's parents. And the undercurrent to this, the subtext is this feeling on the part of today's mothers that the more they do for their children and the more they wear themselves out in the name of serving their kids, the better mothers they are. And I say to mothers out there, you know, your children need mothers who are interesting people. Do something for yourselves.
I like that.
So, you know, one of the things that I hearken my audiences back to is that no previous generation ever thought the raising of children was hard. To which people say, well, times have changed. And I say, well, times have always changed. And yes, we've gone through some profound cultural changes in the last 30 or 40 years, to be sure. But if you look back in history, other cultures have gone through profound changes as well. But those profound changes never seemed to disrupt how the family operated, the understandings that governed the raising of children, and so on and so forth. What happened in America in the 1960s and early 1970s is that we abandoned a biblical model of child rearing and we embraced a psychological model. And one of the things that I say all over the country is we've had enough experience with this psychological model to now know it's not working.
Well, even when you say that psychological model, you know, I think maybe intuitively we can figure out what you mean. But what is that model? What's the primary message?
Well, there's three components to it. The humanistic component says that high self-esteem is a good thing. The behavioral component says that the same principles that govern the behavior of a rat or a dog also govern the behavior of a human being. There's a Darwinian subtext to that. the Freudian component says that parenting produces the child, and all that does is produce tremendous anxiety and guilt for the American parent, especially the American mother. The research has shown clearly, and it's been demonstrated for over 15 years of research, that high self-esteem is not a good thing. It's not a positive attribute.
I'm going to stop you right there for a minute. When you say high self-esteem is not a positive attribute, are you saying that low self-esteem is good or no self-esteem is good? What's the healthy model of that?
Well, the healthy model is respect for others, and the research has shown that it's almost a zero-sum equation, Julie, that a person with high self-esteem tends to have low regard for others, doesn't pay attention to other people, doesn't do a good job of anticipating their needs or responding to their needs, whereas a person with high regard for others is a person who pays attention to other people and looks for opportunities to serve. So it's not that I'm advocating low self-esteem. It's I'm advocating sort of a neutral level of self-esteem, that you not really esteem yourself, that you pay attention to other people, that you have high regard for them.
And you actually get feelings of worth
through that.
When I'm nice to you, when I help you out, when I care about you, God endowed us with a natural reaction that feels good to me. It feels like I'm contributing.
Right.
And that's a healthy sense of self.
It's knowing that you are capable and competent, regardless of your IQ, regardless of your social background, regardless of how much money you make or the family that you come from, of making a positive contribution to the lives of other people. And it's been shown conclusively that people with high self-esteem don't look for opportunities to serve, that they want to be served. It's really an entitlement mentality. And unfortunately, we've infected two generations of children with this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you had said the second belief is kind of the way we train our children is similar to what they do with rats in laboratories, that kids are going to react based on that.
Yeah. The assumption in America today, the reigning disciplinary assumption is that if you manipulate reward and punishment properly, you can have a well-behaved child. That is true of a dog if you manipulate reward and punishment properly, but we are a special creation. The principles that govern the behavior of animals do not govern the behavior of human beings. We have, for example, free will. Dogs do not. A human being can be punished over and over and over again for something and deny that punishment is relevant in his life and keep right on doing the wrong thing. A dog won't do that. There is no mechanism in a dog that's equivalent to the mechanism in a human being that denies that there is authority in his life higher than his own.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why behavior modification has never worked and will never work with human beings. But we were sold this idea by people in our profession, Julie, in the 1960s. We embraced it, thinking people with capital letters after their names have to know what they're talking about. And there's been 40 years of failure, and our children are now today. Parents are having more difficulty with children than their great-grandparents could have possibly imagined.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say that about reinforcements and things like that, do you think there's an element of truth to that? For example, when I'm raising my kids, if one of them complains about dinner, I don't like what you made for dinner, and I say, well, that's fine. You get nothing else to eat tonight. Now, that's a consequence for that behavior. And it seems to work if put in the right context. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I think there's a place for consequences. This, you know, here's the misunderstanding that's common when I start to talk about this, is that people immediately begin to think, well, consequences don't work. Well, really, consequences don't work reliably. You can take two children who are misbehaving in the same way. You can punish them in the same way. One child will stop misbehaving, and one child will begin misbehaving at even a higher level.
Digging those heels in.
Right. Just to prove that you're not the boss of me, you know. So the purpose of consequences is to teach children how the world works, that there are consequences, natural and otherwise, for social consequences, natural consequences for behavior. But the best teaching along those lines does not guarantee a well-behaved child. Whereas, a good dog trainer will tell you, good training results in a well-behaved dog.
Yeah. Now, how about that third element that you said that's part of this very cultural, psychological model that as a parent, I can shape my children and I bear the responsibility for how they turn out and the choices they make. And that does put a lot of guilt, particularly on moms, as you mentioned.
It puts a tremendous amount of pressure on mothers who believe that their children are extensions of them, you know, that their children's behavior and achievement in school, performance in social arena, and so on and so forth, is really a distilled reflection of the quality of their mothering. This puts tremendous pressure on the female parent and contributes to parenting becoming bad for the mental health of women. And I say that all over America. Mm-hmm. I make the statement to every audience, and I say, does anyone disagree that parenting has become bad for the mental health of women? I speak 225 times a year on average. Yeah. No one's ever disagreed. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll stand there and say, and the reason it has become bad for the mental health of women is because Freudian theory leaked its way out of academia into popular culture in the 1960s. And women began to feel that their behavior, their actions, the quality of their mothering determined how well their children behaved and how well they did in school. Hmm.
Some provocative thoughts, some common sense approaches to parenting from our guest today on Focus on the Family, John Rosemond. And Julie, this is, I'm sure we have some people who are stopping right where they are, listening in because they're thinking, wait a minute, you're telling me everything I've done has been wrong. Is that really your message?
I'm telling the audience that we've been on the wrong parenting path for the last 40 years in America, that the problems in American parenting are only going to be solved by America's parents, but ironically or paradoxically, the problems in American parenting were not caused by American parents. They were caused by this new generation of parenting experts, people with capital letters after their names. Hey, John Rosemond's talking about himself. That's exactly right. Now, I go around the country and I say, people like me, we are the problem. Mm-hmm. When we went to our grandparents and other elders in our churches and communities for parenting advice, I think we got better parenting advice than we've gotten from the professional parenting elite over the last 40 years. Mm.
And you know what's so seductive about that, John, is that each of the fallacies that you mentioned in that psychological model have an element of truth, but they've been distorted. And I know that you teach in terms of what a healthy model looks like, and you talk specifically about three R's, that if parents can stick to these, we'll get them right back on track. So let's jump into what those three R's are.
Yeah, let's do. They're respect, responsibility, and resourcefulness, and they're really just, you know, a traditional parenting ethic, basically. You weren't 150, 300, 1,000 years ago trying to raise children who were high achievers, trying to raise kids who did well in school, et cetera, went to the right college. You were trying to raise people who, as adults, would function properly in culture and strengthen culture through respect for others and through compassion and charity and contribution and the like. And so I've, you know, authors, we come up with mnemonic devices to help people remember what we've written. So I distilled all of that that previous parenting character ethic down into the three R's of respect for others, a willingness to accept responsibility and be a responsible citizen, and a resourceful attitude toward the challenges of life. And by the way, these three R's are really uniquely American, and they really defined America for generation after generation since our founding. And we're in danger of losing this. As you know, you said earlier, these kids today are unprepared to deal with the real-world contingencies.
And the thing that came to mind when you were saying that, John, was just citizenship. You know, generations in the past prepared children to be good citizens. And I think that sense of citizenship has been lost. Now, as you mentioned those three R's, let's talk about that first one, respect.
Respect. Respect for others. That's, you know, that's sort of the core of good citizenship, that you pay attention to other people, that you look for opportunities to serve, And part and parcel of that is good manners. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I have noticed in people in my generation, I'm 62 years old, unfortunately, or fortunately, the way depending on the way you look at it, notice is that manners are really lacking in today's kids. And this is not a criticism of those children. And this is really not a criticism of their parents. It's a criticism of a culture that has emphasized prestige and accomplishment. And so parents, from very early on, they begin focusing on their children's accomplishments, teaching their children ABCs when they're 3 years old. Mm-hmm. I didn't learn my ABCs until I went to the first grade. I seem to have learned how to read, you know, yeah. And things like that. We're putting our parenting eggs really in the wrong baskets. Mm-hmm. And the research has come out that says that the more you praise a child, the less well the child does and the less competent the child actually feels, which is, again, counterintuitive. This is an issue that parents struggle with when they hear me talk about the downside of high self-esteem, and there is no upside to it, really. They come up to me and they say, well, I want my child to be confident, John. And I say, well, the best way to build confidence is to teach your child a service ethic, to teach your child to look for opportunities to serve other people, and in so doing, to come to the slow realization on his own without people constantly telling him what a wonderful person he is and what a wonderful job he's doing, that he is capable of making a positive contribution to the lives of others. I've spoken in Amish communities, and the Amish have anything but a high self-esteem ethic. Their ethic is one of humility and modesty and service to others, and they are some of the most tenacious people on the planet. I jokingly say that if we ever have, God forbid, a nuclear holocaust, only the cockroaches and the Amish will survive. So there's no contradiction between having neutral self-esteem, not low self-esteem, that's depression, but just neutral self-esteem and high respect for others and a belief that you are capable of dealing competently with life's challenges.
Yeah, and I think some of that, too, is the words that we use because, you know, maybe good self-esteem, how do you interpret that? Is it inflated if a child has good self-esteem? But biblically, good self-esteem is based on truth. And inflated self-esteem is based on something that's not true. You know, like, for example, it's true that God created me. It's true that he loves me. It's true that I have some strengths. Now, it's also true that he didn't create the world to revolve around me. It's true that I have weaknesses. It's true that I have sin nature. And so when a parent addresses self-esteem based on telling a child the truth, it seems like that just balances out correctly. Would mm-hmm. you agree with that?
I prefer to use the term self-worth, actually, okay. Julie, and, mm-hmm. and you implied that in what you just said. And I prefer to say that it's important, I think, for children to be taught. And of course, they don't understand this when they're very small, but it's something you say to them anyway, and you bring them into an understanding of it as they mature spiritually, that our sense of worth really is derived, as you said, from our relationship with God, who is our creator and who loves us unconditionally. Mm-hmm. That's why we are worthwhile, mm-hmm. not because of the accomplishments that we make in the world.
And you know, John, it's interesting that when we eliminate those two truths, which is what the world has done, you're here by chance because of evolution, not that God uniquely created you. And we've eliminated the truth that God loves you and he sent his son for you. We've got to come up with something. And that's where kind of all this fluff comes on. You're special. Well, based on what? Mm-hmm. Based on your ability. And so we've eliminated the true source of worth. And that's where the need to create all this other stuff, I think, has come from.
And so it becomes accomplishment-oriented, which is really a offshoot of Darwinian survival mm-hmm. of the
yeah.
fittest.
Yeah. That's a great point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you talk about manners, John, one of the things that's difficult with manners is that at some level, it's a fluid concept. In other words, when you and I were growing up, we were taught to address adults as Mr. and Mrs. and their last name. Mm-hmm. Now that's not standard. The manners have shifted that even a well-mannered family might have a small child call me Miss Julie rather than Mrs. Slattery or Dr. Slattery. And so manners are changing, but what are the constant manners that are so important for a parent to be teaching their children, things that don't change over time?
Well, the constant manners are things like not interrupting conversations that take place between adults. The constant manners are when you walk in front of somebody inadvertently, you say, excuse me. The constant manner is opening doors for people. Again, it's all about service to other people. That's what manners are. And what proper instruction in manners accomplishes is it causes the child to stop focusing so much on himself, which is the human tendency. It is probably the beginning of sin. And to begin focusing on other people. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about. You know, my mother, by the time I was 5 years old, she had taught me, you know, when an elevator door opens and you're standing outside waiting for the elevator, you wait until the people inside have gotten off and you step to the side so that their egress is easy. And today, it appears as though young people haven't learned this because I spend a lot of time in hotels and a lot of time in elevators. I can't tell you the number of times I come down to the first floor and there are young people outside the elevator and they get on the elevator and I'm standing there with my rollerboard wanting to get off at the first floor and I just don't make a fuss. I just ride back up to the 10th floor and, you know, try it again. But, you know, but it's like I'm just amazed that simple things like this, which really, they're the glue that holds culture together, are falling by the wayside. I think this is a real tragedy in American culture today.
John, I was raised with six kids, like you're raising your six, and it seems like in a big family, at some level, it's easier to teach some things like waiting your turn, you don't always get your way, respect for others, as John Roseman is saying. Have you found that to be true with a big family?
Well, there are certainly times when you have to navigate that for the kids. I mean, they have to look at the bathroom and say, gee, we don't have a bathroom for every person in the family, so I guess I'll have to wait my turn. Most recently, this has happened in our family as I've helped one of my daughters understand that 15-minute showers will pretty much drain the hot water tank. And that's not very respectful for the other four people that want to shower this morning. But it's a tough one. I mean, it's, as we said earlier, and I don't want to blame this, you know, nameless, faceless culture, but we live in a time when it's all about me. So as kids grow up, they're, I think, just naturally thinking, it's that elevator is for me. It's not for you to get off. It's for me to get on.
Right. And it's the infection of high self-esteem. It's the infection of not thinking about other people and what they need from you at any given moment in time. You know, in the 1960s, I was there when in graduate school and in undergraduate school even, we were as a generation and especially as psychology students presented with this new utopian vision of parenting, which basically said to us, you know, if you stop raising children the way children have always been raised and you embrace this new psychological parenting ethic, you can raise children who are psychologically immaculate. It was a very seductive set of ideas. And you know, in Colossians, we are told in 2:8 to beware deceptive philosophies that are based on man's own thinking rather than on Christ. And this is what we did in the 1960s.
And it's really infiltrated what we have today. You know, as you talk about respect, and I hear that as a parent, wanting to instill respect in my kids' hearts and wanting to teach them manners. And that's swimming upstream, as you've already mentioned. Give parents just a couple things that they can begin to do, even today or tomorrow, to start teaching some simple, basic respect for other people.
Focus on a manner a day or a manner a week in the family. And just, you know, talk about that particular manner, whether it be opening doors for people or saying excuse me or looking people in the eye when they talk to you or whatever it may be. Just pick one a week. And really, instructing children in manners is really all about coaching, which is a lot of what child discipline is truly all about. It's about coaching. It's about teaching children how to behave properly as opposed to misbehaving or behaving improperly. And just go about it in a very well-organized and relaxed kind of way. You'll be amazed at the results.
You know, my parents actually had a manner chart for us growing up for a period of time, and they'd have it in the dining room, and we had, you know, check if you put on the napkin on your lap and keep the elbows off the table. And whenever you got to a certain level, they'd take you out to dinner to a nice restaurant just by yourself to kind of reward those manners.
So who got taken out more often, you or Larry?
I think we're about equal. Yeah, John knows Larry, my brother, and we're very well mannered. Thanks to Mom and Dad.
Rivalry, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Well, John, we only got through one of those three R's, and I really want to get to those other two, and we're out of time for today. So, in the spirit of good manners, would you please be willing to stay with us and continue?
Absolutely. I'm delighted that you would ask. Thank you.
Well, really, it's been our pleasure, and I'm personally glad that you'll be back next time and trust that our listeners can join us as we discuss more of the concepts in your book, The Well-Behaved Child, Discipline That Really Works. And if you'd like to find out more about John Rosemond, about the book, about a CD of this program, and about additional resources to help you in your parenting, just stop by focusonthefamily.com/radio or give us a call toll-free, 800-232-6459, 800, the letter A, and the word family, or in Canada, 1-800-661-9800, online at focusonthefamily.ca. When you're online, be sure to look for details about our Celebrate Family Tour. Two more stops to go this year. We'll be in Seattle, Washington next week on the 11th, and then again in San Diego, California next month. You can register online for these free events, and we hope you can show up. Learn more at focusonthefamily.com/tour. And this reminder that coming up on the 7th is a very special event. It's Orphan Sunday, and it's possible, likely, I hope, that you'll hear discussions at your church about how to reach out to the 145 million orphans worldwide who are waiting for a forever family. Now, there's also a special simulcast that day with Stephen Curtis Chapman, Francis Chan, and many, many others. You can find all the details at our broadcast page. And finally, if you haven't contributed to Focus on the Family recently, we'd invite your participation in what we do, in coming alongside parents and giving you the tools you need to help raise well-behaved kids, as we've discussed today. We'd welcome your contribution over the phone at 1-800, the letter A, and the word family, or in Vancouver, 1-800-661-9800. Our program today was provided by Focus on the Family, and on behalf of Jim Daly, Dr. Julie Slattery, and our entire radio team, thanks for listening. I'm John Fuller, inviting you back tomorrow when we'll hear more from John Rosemond and once again turn our hearts toward home. If you're worn out by soccer practice, honor roll, music lessons, and every other kind of extracurricular activity, here's a reminder, a refreshing one, that your kid's self-worth isn't derived by how many blue ribbons he brings home.
It's important, I think, for children to be taught, and of course they don't understand this when they're very small, but it's something you say to them anyway, that our sense of worth really is derived, as you said, from our relationship with God, who is our creator and who loves us unconditionally. That's why we are worthwhile, not because of the accomplishments that we make in the world.
Ooh, well, I hope that you've just sighed a big sigh of relief there. I certainly have. I'm John Fuller, and this is Focus on the Family with Focus President and author Jim Daly. Hosting today, Dr. Julie Slattery, and our guest, we just heard from him in that clip, is family psychologist John Rosemond. And Julie, there is an intense pressure that most of us feel to connect our sense of parenting success with the achievements of our children, I think.
Oh, there is, John. And the bar is set pretty high. There's so many things you can get your kids involved in and so much pressure for them to excel that I think at some level we're taking our eye off the ball. Mm. We're emphasizing accomplishment, and I think at some level we're ignoring character. And I really believe that our guest today would agree with that and can give us some guidance on how to get out of that trap.
Let me introduce him. John Rosemond is an author and a speaker and, as I said, a family psychologist. He's written several best-selling books, and his nationally syndicated column appears in about 200 newspapers across the U.S. Now, he's been a guest on this program a number of times, and it's a pleasure to have him back today to pick up where we left off last time. And once again, joining us here in the studio, kind of observing along the periphery, are students from the Focus Leadership Institute.
And John, I really appreciate John Rosemond's voice in our culture. He brings us back to the traditional biblical principles and reminds us that we probably make this parenting thing more complicated than it needs to be. And he's really summarized parenting into three R's: respect, responsibility, and resourcefulness. And John, last time we talked about that first R, teaching children to respect others and to care about others more than they care about themselves. But that second R, a responsibility, that's a big one. What does that look like?
Well, there's really two components to that. It's accepting responsibility for your own behavior, which is called accountability. And then there's also the contribution part of responsibility, which is that you find a way to make a positive contribution to society in terms of productivity. So you are a responsible person in terms of your contribution, and you're a responsible person in terms of accountability. Those two things really go hand in hand, and they are under that umbrella.
Now, can you give me just a modern day, you probably have hundreds of them, but one or two examples of how this is lacking in the average family today?
Well, the way children used to be taught the contribution aspect of responsibility is through chores. And again, I'll remind our audience that I'm 62 years old. And, so I have a different view of this than many of the parents who are listening, because they're in their 30s or perhaps 40s. And a lot of this began to fall by the wayside after my generation grew up. In fact, it was my generation that caused it to begin falling by the wayside when we became parents. We failed to put our children into responsible contributing positions in the family. We put the American family and the American child in terms of his responsibility ethic on the slippery slope, and we've been sliding down it ever since. In my generation, you began doing chores as early as you could remember. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was 3.5 years old, my mother taught me to wash floors. And she was a single parent for most of the first 7 years of my life, but she didn't have me washing floors because she needed my help, the help of a 3.5-year-old. Mm-hmm. She had me washing floors because she believed, as people used to say, good citizenship begins at home. Mm-hmm. And so children needed to be responsible members of the family. They needed to have positive contributing roles in the family. And, before I'm 5 years old, my mother has me washing my own clothes in her washing machine, which was a galvanized tub that sat on the side porch with hand rollers bolted to it.
Wow.
And I talk to other people my age and I go, what were your chores? And, you know, they're equal sorts of things. You ask today's parents, what are your children doing in the house? Uh-huh. And they're watching TV and they're playing video games and they're on the computer and they're not contributing to the family. They're just there. And this is not good for the American family. It's not good for America, because these kids, when they get out into the world, they really don't have a clear understanding that relationships are a two-way street, whether it be a husband-wife relationship or an employer-employee relationship. This is not an entitlement program working for whatever corporation you work for. And it's contributing, but it's not fair to the child. Mm-hmm. That's where it all, the pigeons come home to roost on the child when the child is an adult. We're really weakening American children.
We're not teaching them the basic principles of delaying gratification,
exactly,
working for something. I was just having this conversation with my mom yesterday. We were talking about what's happening with the mortgages and the defaults, and she was telling me the story about how hard she and my dad worked to get together that first down payment. And, you know, just the effort that went into that. They had to live in a trailer park for many years and work hard and scrape their pennies together. And nowadays, there's that instant, hey, just sign your name here. You don't have to have responsibility. And so we see this hitting all different sectors of society, but it's that basic work ethic of you've got to work for something and wait for something that's being lost.
Well, employers are telling me all over America that the new problem that they have to deal with in the workplace is parents of young adult children, college-educated, college-graduated children, calling the workplace to complain about how their children are being treated.
Oh.
You know, and it's like, excuse me?
That's pretty extreme.
That is really extreme. I talked to a fellow who was a Fortune 500 manager. And he told me that they had a national management meeting for 3 days in Denver, Colorado, a couple of years ago. One full day was devoted to how to deal with these phone calls and how to deal with these angry parents storming into the workplace and demanding to see the supervisor who reprimanded their, you know, their immaculate child the day before. And it is indication that we're not teaching children to be accountable for their own behavior. And of course, this is the second component of responsibility, that you accept full accountability, that you accept that you are the person who brings consequences on yourself. Nobody else does that. You know, it's your choices that result in the experiences, whether they be positive or negative, in the world. And this is the parent intervening in the workplace is just symptomatic of, again, something that's terribly unfair to America's kids.
It starts in the elementary school with the mom that runs the report the child forgot, and then it gets into high school where you help with a project that they forgot to do, and you just don't know where to stop enabling, it sounds like.
I went to my mother, and this is a story that is sounds very familiar to people my age when I tell it. I went to my mother once and asked her for help with homework. And this very intelligent college-educated woman thanked me for inviting her to go with me to the third grade again. But she said, I've already been, and I don't want to go again. And, you know, the message was clear. I'm not going to do your homework, and I'm not going to help you with your homework. And, you know, so I learned to do my homework, and I learned that, you know, sometimes I did it better than others, and hey, you know, it's no big deal to take back a piece of homework that has a few mistakes on it. It's not crippling.
John, there are parents who are saying, you don't understand, though. My child has 2 hours of homework tonight and tomorrow night and the next night. If I don't help them, they'll be up till 10 or 11 or 12 at night.
Not if you take them out of all the irrelevant after-school activities that they're in, you know, which is a radical thing to say, you know. But I mean, truly, I hear this from teachers all over the country, that they get notes from parents saying, my child couldn't finish his homework last night because cheerleading practice lasted too long, or the soccer game was interrupted by rain and didn't end until 10 o'clock at night, and that sort of thing. Again, it's a matter of priorities. You know, if your child does have 2 hours of homework every night, then he doesn't need to be in a lot of after-school activities. That just makes sense, I would hope. But the other thing is that I have found that children who do their own homework, they work more persistently. They get the homework done more rapidly than if the parent is sitting there. That the parent thinks they have to sit there in order to help the child get the homework done, when exactly the opposite is true.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we have to put a disclaimer in there that there are going to be some kids that have some learning disabilities, that are really struggling, that are going to need some parental guidance through this. You know, I have one guy that just kind of struggles with paying attention, and we're teaching him some of those skills, but he's not as independent naturally as one of my other children would be. And so there's some sensitivity in there as well.
Yeah, exactly, Julie. I mean, you've got to adjust your expectations for each child, for sure. But there is this fine line between serving as a consultant to your child when it comes to things like homework, and when you cross that line, you inadvertently, with the best of intentions, become an enabler. And it's a hard line for parents to walk, especially when they've got a child who's got attention problems or learning problems, sure.
Our guest today on Focus on the Family is John Rosemond. I'm John Fuller. Our host is Dr. Julie Slattery. And on this matter of responsibility, John, I'm just thinking about parents who want to protect their child from failure. I don't want my child to struggle and fail, and that's why I'm helping them. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
I ask my audiences dealing with this very issue, I'll say, raise your hand if you disagree with this. The most valuable learning experiences in your life have come about as a result of failure or the lack of the level of success that you were looking for. And nobody raises a hand, nobody disagrees. And I point out to people that if we want our children to be armored against failure, we need to teach them how to deal with it while they are children. Mm-hmm. This is when we put that armor on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember in Akron, Ohio, the school that my kids went to, the principal had this plaque on her desk, and it was just a profound statement. It said, "Prepare your child for the road, not the road for your child." That seems to summarize a lot of what you're saying. Mm.
That's a great statement. I'll take it, put it in my next book, and pretend I made it up.
Well, so how do we do this? You know, let's say you got my attention. I recognize that I need to be instilling more responsibility and accountability. Give, again, some age-appropriate, reasonable expectations that I can start to implement today and tomorrow.
Well, you know, I like to tell stories. So here's a story about my daughter Amy, who's now 37 years old. She was in the sixth grade. One day she came running up to me at about 6 o'clock in the evening and in this obvious panic, and she said, "Daddy, Daddy, you've got to take me to the drugstore. I've got to buy some poster paper, and I've got to buy some glue, and I've got to buy some other things." And I said, "Well, why do you have to do this now at 6 o'clock in the evening?" "My science project is due tomorrow," she said. I looked at her and said, "How long have you known about the science project?" And she said, "2 weeks." And I said, "Well, why are you telling me you're just getting around to doing it? You've known about it for 2 weeks?" She said, kind of in this very dramatic, "I forgot."
I can relate to that. I don't know about you, John.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've heard that before.
And I looked at her and I said, "Well, I understand about forgetting because I think I've just forgotten how to drive."
Wow.
And she went, "No, you haven't." I went, "Well, Amy, the bottom line is I'm not taking you to the drugstore at 6 o'clock in the evening to get this material for your science project. You should have let me know about this a week or two ago." Mm-hmm. "We could have gone in a very relaxed way. I've got other plans for the evening, and they don't include driving you to the drugstore and hanging around helping you pick out materials for your science project." And she wailed, and she moaned, and she gnashed her teeth, you know. She went through all the drama. And the next day, I wrote a note to her teacher telling her teacher exactly what happened and asking her teacher to please give her the grade she deserves. Mm-hmm. And it was such a learning experience in Amy's life. We talk about it even today when she's 37 and we laugh about it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, she still remembers that.
Oh, yeah. But I emphasize we laugh about it because, you know, she thought it was apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. She thought she could never survive this, you know, and she survived it quite nicely and been strengthened by it, in fact.
That seems so counterintuitive to a lot of parenting these days. I mean, I drove by a school the other day that had a sign that said, "Where every child succeeds." And I just thought, boy, I don't want my kid going there. But I'm not sure I'd want to be so hard-lined with my child. John, how do I do that? I mean, how do I pull up the reserves within me to A, say no, and then D, deal with the wailing and gnashing of teeth? Because that's not pleasant, and I don't like that.
Well, it's just having a long range. I call it a Proverbs 22:6 view of parenting. You know, it's the long range view. It's the far-sighted view. And too many parents today, and I don't mean this as a criticism, I just an observation, they're operating on the basis of immediate objectives, immediate goals, mm-hmm. immediate considerations. And I tell people that our parenting ought to be aimed at the adults we want our children to be when our children are 30 years old.
Begin with the end in mind.
Right. Begin with the end in mind, that you think down the road, what kind of adult do I want my child to be when my child is 30 years old? You aim your parenting at that, and it causes your day-to-day decisions to be a lot different than if your day-to-day decisions are driven by immediate concerns and considerations.
Mm. Now, if I'm remembering correctly, John, you learned this in the process. You, as a parent, started out maybe with a more permissive parenting philosophy and adjusted along the way. Is that right?
Maybe with a more.
I'm couching that
You're
a little bit.
You're being very polite. That's good manners.
All right, thanks.
my wife and I were seduced by the new psychological model. It sounded wonderful. And, we headed down that road. And our son, Eric, who is a fine human being and has given me permission to say this in public, in the third grade, his teacher told us he was the worst behaved child she'd seen in 20 years of teaching.
That's pretty bad.
And this was like, the 2x4 upside the head, as we say in North Carolina. You know, it caused my wife and I to really step back from what we were doing, evaluate what we were doing, and realize that we had consciously made the decision to raise our own children in a way that was 180 degrees removed from the way we ourselves had been raised. And so what we did was, within probably a month, we just had rotated our parenting back to a traditional direction, 180 degrees. 3 months later, Eric's teacher told us that he was a model student. She said, "I don't know what you're doing, but keep on doing it," So it was that experience that really caused me to begin realizing, and it's been, I'm a work in progress. I'm still trying to understand some things, this was the event that really kicked John Roseman and the work that I've been doing in the direction that I've been going ever since.
So when you talk about making these midstream changes, you've been there, and you know how the kids react when mom and dad come home and say it's a new day, there's a new sheriff in town, we're going to handle things differently than we have.
I have been there, Julie. I have done that. I know that it's not easy. I know that it's, you just have to grit your teeth and plunge in. Mm-hmm. Not impulsively. You've got to develop a game plan. You've got to know what you're doing. Willie and I, one of the things we did along those lines is we sat down and we made a list of all the household chores that we were doing. Our kids were on the dole completely, 10 and 6 years old. And we realized that except for mowing grass and cooking and ironing clothes, that our children could do everything that was involved in the housework. So we drew up a chore schedule, posted it on the refrigerator, described each chore on an index card that went into an index file on the kitchen counter. The kids came home from school one day and we simply announced, "We've retired from doing housework. You guys are doing it from now on. You're learning how to run a household." And I'll never forget Eric, the older of the two, now 40, he looked at me and he said, "Well, Dad, what are you going to pay us?" And I said, "Well, we're going to let you live here. We're going to heat your room in the winter and air condition it in the summer and put food on your plate, shoes on your feet, and stuff like that."
And I'll let you know, I've used that line with my kids.
That's great. That's great. It's a great line.
Well, we need to get to that third R, because it's just as important as the other two. So tell us about resourcefulness.
Well, resourcefulness is the belief that you are capable of dealing with life's challenges. And, the shortcut to that discussion is to say that, it is the tendency of every parent in the world to want to, when they see their child struggling with something, jump in and solve the problem. I've been there. I've done that. And it's just a matter of, again, disciplining yourself to the vision of Proverbs 22:6 and understanding that these struggles pay off in the child's life, and for you to jump in and solve these problems is probably not going to pay off most of the time. And again, you have to be judicious, you have to be selective, and you have to take your own child and his or her abilities and needs into consideration. But I think it's a given that today's parents are, with the best of intentions, solving entirely too many problems for their kids.
And moms, I think, are probably more guilty of this than dads. Would you agree with that, John?
Yeah, that's one of the conflict points in our home is I'll talk to my wife about something the kids are doing, and she'll say, well, I was going to stop by the store and pick that up, and I'll just ask, why? Mm-hmm. I mean, the child in question has a driver's license. That child can easily stop by. He, in this case, has a lot more free time than you or I. Let him do that. And she'll say, oh, yeah, you're right. And yeah. I think it's that nurturer in her that just doesn't want to let go sometimes.
Well, you know, we had a situation like this just a few days ago. One of our kids came home from school, and he had had a really tough day emotionally, and he didn't handle it well. He wanted to come home from school early and, you know, pretend like he was sick. And so we were dealing with it from a discipline point of view of what could you have done differently? And my response to that, well, next time maybe what you should do is call me and just tell me that you're having a hard day. We'll talk about it over the phone. And my husband stopped me. And he said, no. You can handle that on your own. He said to our son, you know, this is how you do it. You just tell your teacher you need a few minutes to gather yourself. And then you take some time, and then you're ready to go on with your day. And as I thought of his advice, mine was so much more maternal and nurturing, but my husband's advice was the right advice to really teach our son to cope with that challenge in his mm-hmm. life rather than running to mommy. But moms like that. They like being the support for their kids. It's hard to give up.
I think John is right. I think that that is a maternal tendency, you know, to want to jump in there and be the nurturer. And the dad is the parent who pushes the child out of the nest, you know, in the final analysis, who says, it's time for you to go.
That's because the dad wants the nest alone with mom.
Well, that may be too, Julie, yeah, which is a valid reason, by the way.
I know that part of the resourcefulness you talk about is teaching kids to use their imagination and creativity, which with technology and TV and video games has all but been lost in this generation.
It really and truly has, Julie. But, you know, I've been going around the country for over 20 years now preaching this very few toys, no TV or very little TV philosophy. And now it's very little internet, very little electronics. And there are people out there who have listened, and there are people out there who don't give their children a lot of toys and don't let their children watch TV and get on the internet and play video games and so on and so forth. And to a person, these people testify to me that their children entertain themselves, mm-hmm. they're fun children to be around, they're imaginative. At the age of 7, they're up in their room doing the 1 7-year-old girl's show of Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs, you know, playing every part up in their room. And this is what childhood to me ought to be all about. Childhood should not be encumbered by a lot of material things and like a lot of toys and video games and so on and so forth. Again, all of this stuff comes back to, you know, a focus on what's best for children and what type of adults are we trying to raise here? You know, we're not raising children. We need to understand that we're really mm-hmm. raising adults, and we mm-hmm. really do need to cast our vision out into the future.
You know, I'm going to bring up something that might create some dialogue with you and me here, but I think it'll be helpful for our listeners, and I'll Great. Probably learn a thing or two. But I would add a fourth R, and I know it's something that you just said may not be that important, but to me, the relationship with a child is the context for teaching respect, teaching resourcefulness, teaching responsibility. Just as scripture, you know, even God's discipline is in the context of a relationship. How important is that fourth R of relationship?
Well, you have to have a relationship in order to be a proper leader, a proper coach, a proper mentor in your child's life. You know, Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 and 7 is the first scripture where God talks directly to parents and says, impress these commandments, which he's referring to the values that are shared by the Hebrew tribes. Impress these commandments, these values upon your children at every possible opportunity as you're walking down the road, preparing for bed at night, et cetera, et cetera. So God is talking about a relationship, but he's talking about the relationship between a coach or a leader mm-hmm. and a person who is being coached or being led. So it's not about the kind of relationship where you're seeking approval. It's not about the kind of relationship where you're seeking immediate gratification. Mm-hmm. It's a relationship of leader and student, or teacher and student, coach and coachee, mm-hmm. however you would put that. But indeed, Julie, it does require a relationship, but it's not a friendship. The season of friendship with your child comes when your child is emancipated.
And you're able to enjoy that now as you have grown yeah. children. Mm-hmm. So it's a yeah. strong relationship, but it's not a friendship. It's not equals negotiating and a democracy. As I know I've heard you put before, it's a benevolent dictatorship.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, my kids have grown up, and we've had to learn to like each other, you know, as adults. You know, there was no question about how they had to feel about me when they were kids, you know. But now as adults, they've had to learn how to have a relationship with me as two peers, which, you know, it's a transition that you make in your child's life. And I can tell you this, that if you try to be friends with your child when you should be a leader to your child, you're going to have difficulty establishing a friendship with your child when you should be a friend to your child.
Mm. Well, John, you've given us a lot to consider, and I'm going to put on the hat that I am of a mom who's just trying to wade through. I want to raise my kids the right way. I know my husband does as well. We want to raise them according to biblical principles. We want to prepare them for adulthood well, and we're fighting that battle. Sometimes it feels overwhelming. Sometimes you feel like you're fighting all of culture. What word of encouragement do you have, even for that single parent who is even more overwhelmed with the burden of trying to raise kids that are respectful, responsible, and resourceful? Leave us with a word of encouragement.
Well, the word of encouragement that I would leave people with is to, again, take the long view, take the Proverbs 22:6 view, and understand that the things you're doing today, you may not reap any reward from the things that you do today for 20 or 30 years to come, depending upon the age of your child today. But the reward that you will reap 25 or 30 years down the road is so much richer than the reward you will reap today if your considerations are short-term.
That's great advice, John. I really appreciate that. And for our listeners, you don't have the benefit, as we do here in the studio, of knowing that our Focus Leadership Institute students are with us. You might have heard them along the way here, and we do have a few questions from them. So let me address you as students and just tell you that we'd love for you to step up to the mics and to give us your name and the school you attend, and then your question for John Rosemond.
My name is Jordan, and I'm a student at the University of Minnesota. My question has to do with something you mentioned earlier when you were speaking about children taking responsibility for their actions. And you had mentioned that it would be better for them to be involved in less extracurricular activities in order to be more accountable with their schoolwork, which I guess I have a question regarding that, being a student who has gone through the college search and application, et cetera, wondering, in our culture, it's expected of us to have accomplished a lot of things and to have these extracurricular activities and achievements. I'm wondering, how do you counter the culture by implementing this type of responsibility and teaching that to your children, but still make it into college when everybody's fighting for that spot? I feel like it's kind of difficult if you haven't been involved in those things to actually stand out in any way. What would you say to that?
I would say that I've never heard of a child who was denied college entrance because the child didn't participate in a slew of after-school activities as he or she was growing up. A good student is going to find a college that will accept them. And the research has clearly, once again, shown that if you want to talk about accomplishment for a minute, that when you look at 100 people who have accomplished something grand in a certain profession, that these 100 people are somewhat evenly distributed between Ivy League colleges, small state colleges, small private colleges, small Christian colleges, that the college you go to really, contrary to what a lot of parents think and what a lot of young people think and are caused to think by high school counselors and the like, the college that you go to, really, that's not as big a determining factor in the success of your life as people seem to think that it is.
And there's a lot of competition. You're really right about that, that there's the need to have volunteered and be involved in some extracurricular things. That's a lot of pressure. But I think you're saying, John, that is so true, is that if parents can focus on raising a well-rounded kid with character, and maybe that means closing the doors to some, you know, prestigious athletic team or a scholarship for musical ability or creating a prodigy, but it's the salt of the earth citizen, regardless of where they go to college or even maybe whether they go to college, that really is leading a life that contributes to society, and that maybe God will just use because he has a servant's heart rather than trying to be number one in the class.
There you go. One of my best friends who is a pediatrician in Sacramento, California, dropped out of high school, went into the military, spent 6 years in the military, came out of the military, started going back to high school, got his GED, went to college, and he's now a highly respected pediatrician and man of God in Sacramento, California. And by the way, he'd rather be known as a man of who believes in Christ and who follows Christ than he would be known as a leading pediatrician. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, to me, we in the Christian community, we need to keep our focus, you know, that it's all of the diplomas on the walls and the trophies, as you pointed out, John, that's not what's important in the final analysis, you know.
And parents have to make these choices. Yeah. I know, John, you're in the middle of this, but you have to say no to some things in order to have quality family time, investing in those relationships, teaching your children character, having them do chores. You're going to have to say no to having them excel at some things, perhaps, but you're investing in the character of the person and trusting that in the end that's going to pay a lot more dividends than being the best at something.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm Megan, and I go to Eastern University in southeastern Pennsylvania. My question would be, what would you say to the parents who are hearing this for the first time and they have like teenagers or preteen age children? Like, how would they go back and kind of not fix but replace some of the behaviors that their children have learned that don't fit into these three R's?
Well, I would say to parents of teenagers, and I encounter that question, Megan, a lot, in fact, from parents of teens. You know, they'll come to hear me talk and they'll come up to me afterwards and say, you know, my gosh, I realize I've got a lot to do here, a lot of things to fix, and where do I start? And I say, well, look, your job is to do the right thing. That's all your job is. Your job is not to produce a certain type of human being. Your job is simply to do the right thing. And with a teenager, your influence in your child's life may have waned to the point where no matter how good a job you do from this point on, there's some things that are set in concrete or pretty much so in your child's life. But do the right thing anyway, regardless of the outcome. You know, that's what we Christians need to do in the world, in whatever place in the world we're working. And if your work is done in the home, in parenting, then just do the right thing.
There's a certain thing a parent needs to have, and that is fairly thick skin. Because I can hear the parent telling the kids, hey, it's a new day. You did that, John, with your children and house chores, but they were 10 and 6. Tell a couple of teens it's time to pony up and start paying your dues, and you'll probably get some pushback.
You know, again, I'm a guy who's full of stories, and I love stories, and I love stories that parents tell me. And a woman came up to me recently somewhere in America, and she said, she related this story about, you know, how she heard me speak somewhere, and she went home, and she had this 16-year-old daughter, and she was a single mother, only child, and she had entered into this buddy-buddy relationship with her child. And I had talked a lot about how parenting is not about a relationship, it's about leadership. And she came back to hear me talk like a year later, and she said, John, I went home and I basically told my daughter, we're not friends anymore, I'm not your friend, I'm running the show here, it's not my job to be liked by you, etc. And she said, it took about 6 months, and my daughter finally came up to me and she said, you know, I like you a whole lot better now that you're not my friend. Huh. So these things do work out if you do the right thing. And again, it's don't look for the instant reward. Don't look for the instant payoff. Just, you know, bide your time if you do the right thing. Not always, but more often than not, the right thing will eventually happen.
And that brings to mind, some parents hear what you have to say, and they're energized, they're gung-ho, they want to make this huge change in their home, but they can't maintain that. Would you say it's better to start with small steps that you can maintain?
Well, I think it depends. I think it depends on your own personality, what you think you can accomplish, and so on and so forth. I think you have to make that judgment for yourself. I mean, the woman in question just went home and jumped in with both feet and told her child, hey, you know, it's a new day dawning here between you and I. I'm not your friend anymore. Get used to it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was like she realized she had no time to waste here. She might as well just cause her daughter to confront the truth. And I had to just applaud her when she told me this story. You know, it was just a great thing. But other parents, if you're listening out there and you don't feel comfortable with jumping in with both feet, then develop a plan, stretch it out over time, and take it a step at a time. You know, the old baby steps thing in the movie, What About Bob?
Hmm. Yeah. Hey, my name is Maria Gerald, and I'm from North Carolina. I just graduated from Appalachian State University with a degree in elementary education. And I know that you talked a lot about parents enabling irresponsibility in their children rather than supporting them and helping them to become responsible adults. And as children spend a large portion of their day at school, how important do you believe it is for teachers and parents to partner in helping children to become the responsible adults that they should be rather than enabling irresponsibility in them?
Maria, that's a great question. I often talk about the alliance that needs to be formed between parent and teacher on the child's behalf, and how there's been a breakdown of that alliance, that today's parents tend to be rather suspicious of, for lack of a better term, the influence the teacher is having on the child, especially when the teacher attempts to discipline. 50 years ago in America, when a teacher disciplined a child, the child was disciplined again at home. It was a reliable formula. And today, teachers all over America tell me they discipline children and the parent calls the school and complains. And again, it's not fair for a child to see that adults cannot agree on what is in his or her own best interest. And I talk about that a lot, so great question.
That's great advice, John. Thanks so much for being willing to come and just share the very common sense biblical principles that we just need to be reminded of. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. I always enjoy being here at Focus with you folks. I always have a good time. Thank you.
And I'm especially grateful for that long-term perspective that you've encouraged here at the tail of our conversation. Well, for more, certainly follow up with John's book, The Well-Behaved Child, and a CD of this conversation. Be sure to visit as well our online parenting forum or subscribe to our Thriving Family magazine for trusted advice that you can rely on for your family. You can find it all at focusonthefamily.com/radio or in Canada, focusonthefamily.ca. And you might have heard me mention this before, but a reminder that this Sunday is Orphan Sunday. We trust that you'll hear about the plight of 145 million orphans worldwide and how you can reach out to them in Jesus' name. We have details at our broadcast page, as well as a link to a special video presentation with Stephen Curtis Chapman and Francis Chan. And by the way, I didn't mention it, but our phone number here, if you have any questions about what you've heard today or you'd like some additional follow-up materials, 1-800-232-6459, or in Canada, call our Vancouver office at 1-800-661-9800. And when you have us on the line, be sure to tell us what radio station you're listening to, or perhaps you're using our iPhone app, or you're downloading the podcast version of this program, or streaming it, or listening on satellite radio. And also, please consider a financial gift to our work in coming alongside and helping families thrive. Our program today provided by Focus on the Family, and on behalf of Jim Daly, Dr. Julie Slattery, and our entire radio team, thanks for listening in. I'm John Fuller, hoping you have a great weekend and that you listen to Weekend Magazine on many of these same stations on Saturday and Sunday. inviting you back on Monday when we'll hear from author and pastor Andy Stanley about God's amazing grace as we once again turn our hearts toward home.